I'm your host, Jared Holt. Today is December 9th, 2019, and this is Shitpost. Alright, welcome back to Shitpost, my faithful listeners. I want to apologize. Last week there was no episode of Shitpost, and that was because I was traveling in New York. Here in a couple weeks, we're going to miss another episode while I am at a undisclosed location for the holidays. Thanks for sticking along. I think this episode's going to be really interesting and good. But before we get started, I hate to do this, but I have to issue a blanket ban on Baby Yoda shit until we figure out what's going on. I am so fucking tired of this Baby Yoda shit. And I think what sent me over the edge was this song. I guess it's like a Hamilton Baby Yoda mashup. I'm going to play a little bit of it. It was posted to Twitter, and I will see how long I can last on this.
Dear Baby Yoda, what to say to you? You have big eyes, we don't yet know your name. When you came across the screen, you cooed, and it broke my heart. I'm dedicating every meme to you. Galactic life had never known such style. You make me smile.
All right, I think we're done with that. Yeah, that pushed me over the edge this week. I am tired of Baby Yoda. We're not doing Baby Yoda. It's not going to come up on this episode again or any episode ever again. Ixnay, Baby Yoda. Okay, I got that out of my system. Let's get on to the news. We could be very close to finding out if believing in the QAnon conspiracy theory makes you insane, if you can be considered unfit to stand trial if you believe in this. And I think that's going to be a very, very interesting point in this weird world that we're in right now. Regular listeners of the show will remember Anthony Comello. He pulled off somehow a high profile mob killing. He killed Francesco Cali. You know, of all the people that would want to kill this mob boss, it was this 25-year-old dude who just showed up and thought that, you know, this guy was part of the deep state and that, you know, he's got to show up and call the army to come arrest him, and just ends up shooting the guy and killing him. Anthony Comello made a lot of headlines. He showed up to one court appearance with a Q written on his hand and his phrases with the conspiracy theory, associated with the conspiracy theory, written around it. So, I mean... his lawyer is taking what I think is probably the smartest move, maybe. I'm no lawyer, but he is going to pose the question of, you know, at what point does believing in this far-right conspiracy theory make you considered legally insane? In New York, clearing that bar for being considered legally insane is quite high. You have to show that you not only have mental illness, but that the illness prevents you from understanding the consequences of your actions or from understanding them as morally wrong. Of course, the prosecution is arguing that Anthony Comello, is mentally competent and can be held responsible. And the lead prosecutor on the case says that Anthony Comello's mind was crystal clear when he waived his right to a lawyer during an interview with detectives. I think cases like this are going to come up more. I don't think this is the end of the road here. But it is an interesting question. At what point do you believe something that subtracts you from reality so much that you disconnect and, you know, the state would consider you legally insane. Now, to be clear, my personal take on this is I think it's probably very unlikely that Anthony Comello is considered legally insane in this case. I don't anticipate that that defense will work. I do imagine that they will try him as somebody who is not legally insane and that he will go to prison. But the fact that this is being tried at all is pretty remarkable. Artists on Twitter are saying that their work has been regularly stolen by armies of bots that generate t-shirts from popular designs, and it seems that they've got documentation to prove that this is happening. So here's how it looks. It looks like bots that are, hired out by popular t-shirt sales platforms like Redbubble and whatnot, appear to be crawling around Twitter with people saying, I want that on a t-shirt, or can I get that on a t-shirt? And within hours, vendors on Amazon, Toucan Style, Motif, they suddenly have a t-shirt with that art on it. And they're taking the art from the artist without getting the approval, and certainly not paying them. And to get it taken down is slow moving. I can imagine it would be hard to really try to seek out justice for this without some sort of legal element to it. Lawyers getting involved. But it's kind of just like one interesting piece of a bigger problem, which is that stealing artwork online, just because of the nature of the internet, is incredibly easy. And companies have gamified it with bots in order to try to spin a quick buck. Amazon is absolutely covered in stolen artwork and sometimes never does anything about it. That theft happens on Instagram too. Amazon has an epidemic with counterfeiting popular goods. It's really kind of nutty. And something that some of the artists have done, because corporations like Disney have big legal teams to fight intellectual property theft, they are creating art with Disney characters and getting people to trigger the bots to make them into t-shirts in hopes that, you know, Disney can take retribution against these companies that maybe they don't have the means to do this. The point being is this whole thing is a mess.
I'm a fucking mess.
We are just about a year out from the next U.S. presidential election, and the world's biggest social media companies like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram still can't figure out how to get rid of manipulation on their platforms. There was an exercise performed by NATO Stratcom to test whether Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram could detect malicious activity. For 4 months, they ran an experiment on 105 different social media posts across the four platforms and hired out something called MSPs. That stands for Manipulation Service Providers. And that's just a fancy name for being able to buy clicks and buy likes and shares on your social media posts. It's absurdly cheap. NATO Stratcom spent about $300, a little bit more, and they bought 3,530 comments, 25,750 likes, 20,000 views, and 5,100 followers across the four platforms. They were able to identify the accounts that were being used to manipulate the statistics, identifying more than 18,000 of them, and then were able to reverse engineer it to see what other pages those accounts were interacting with. 4 weeks after they purchased this service for these fake accounts to come interact with their pages, 80% approximately were still active. Even though they, submitted a report to these companies that, these fake accounts and here's what some of them look like, 95% of them were still online. So all of this is to say that, some of the biggest sources of information in our modern era don't know how to counter behavior on the platform that's inauthentic. And it's my theory that there's not much of an incentive for these companies to do so. It certainly does pose a risk by manipulating posts online to make them seem like they're getting more authentic engagement than they are. You can inflate ideas and inflate figures and make them seem more important or more credible. But I'm sure to a lot of these companies, it's just engagement numbers. It's things to take back to the shareholders. So be interested to see how seriously these companies take inauthentic behavior on their platforms, because right now it doesn't seem like it's too serious. A California jury found on Friday that Tesla and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk had not defamed 64-year-old British cave explorer Vernon Unsworth after calling him a pedo guy on Twitter. Ryan Mack, a senior tech reporter for BuzzFeed News, was at the trial and joins us now. Hey, Ryan.
Hey, man. How's it going?
Hey, pretty good. It sounds like you had a pretty interesting week last week at this trial.
I can say it was unlike any other week I've had so far, but yeah.
Yeah, once in a lifetime, I would think. So I guess first we should rehash exactly what this whole situation was about for people who maybe don't remember it or didn't see it when it happened. This started, I guess we should start at the submarine that Elon Musk wanted to build to save a group of, I think it was a boys' soccer team in a cave in Thailand.
Yeah, that's correct. I don't know how much time you got to rehash this thing, but you start back in July or June 2018 when a group of 12 boys on a Thai soccer team get caught in a cave with their coach. They're just hanging out, exploring, and they get caught in a cave as water rushes in Chiang Rai, Thailand. And so they get trapped there. They're eventually found by some... Actually, for a while, they're reported as missing. There's a huge search effort that goes out for them. Eventually, they're found, but they're trapped inside a cave such that they can't get out because all the passageways have filled with water, and they're kind of up on a higher shelf, and they've been there without food and water, and they're stuck there. And so it's a monsoon season in Thailand. Waters are rising, and so they have a limited amount of time to rescue these kids before something terrible happens. And so... Vernon Unsworth, who is a British man who lives part of the year in Thailand, and is actually he helps map caves and map that cave specifically, is called in to help a lot helps organize a rescue effort. Kind of late in that process in July, by the time it's July 2018, Elon Musk gets involved. A lot of people are asking him on Twitter to get involved to see if he can engineer a solution. And he
right because if he if he can make an electric car, surely he can rescue some kids.
So he builds what's effectively a tube. He calls it a mini sub. Tests it in a pool. Brings it over. It's never used. It's never proved to work. But he makes the trip over anyways with his team as they also try out some other solutions. In any case, they use traditional kind of diving techniques to dive these kids out. Although they did have to sedate them, and it was a whole long process. It was obviously very dangerous. One of the Thai divers actually died. And so the kids were rescued. Sub was never used. The day after, or a couple days after, Vernon Unsworth gives an interview to CNN. And he calls, he's asked about the submarine and Musk, and he calls it, for one thing, a publicity stunt. And he says that Musk can shove the sub where it hurts, basically, kind of as a euphemism for a thing not working.
So then Elon Musk takes to Twitter and through the series of a few tweets calls him a pedo guy. And it turned into a lawsuit, one that suggested $190 million in damages.
Right.
So you were on the scene covering this trial. Can you set the mood for us? If we're going to vibe check this courtroom, what's going on?
So I showed up on Monday, and there had already been 2 days of pretrial conferences. This Monday was the last day of pretrial conferences, and Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday was the trial and the jury verdict. To be honest, it was a lot calmer than I thought it would be. I mean, of course, there was a lot of press. There's a lot of British outlets there as well. I think this was a very British story. It's obviously a British citizen being possibly defamed by a billionaire entrepreneur CEO. A lot of British press. But other than that, not like really many of other observers in a way. The room was interesting, A, because I didn't think this thing was going to go to trial. I thought most civil cases settle. Most defamation cases are extremely hard to prove in the U.S.
Right.
So most of these things end up settling, and you get into the courtroom on Monday and you realize that it's not that cordial between the two sides, and that kind of plays out throughout the rest of the case. I mean, Musk had clearly instructed his – I actually don't know this, but it seemed like he instructed his attorneys to get him a result. Vernon Unsworth's side similarly had been instructed to play this out and see where it takes them, and we get, lo and behold, a jury trial with one of the most richest, powerful people in the world. Yeah.
Yeah, I was also surprised that this thing even made it into court, just given that the bar you have to clear in a U.S. court to prove defamation and seek damages is just absurdly high. I mean, what was the argument that you know, Vernon Unsworth was and his attorneys were trying to make as far as justifying $190 million in damages?
Well, there's a couple parts of that defamation claim. And so early on in the pretrial conferences, it was the judge basically determined, look, Unsworth isn't a public figure. And so the bar for defamation against non-public figures in this country, although it's high, is not as high as if you were a public figure. And when you're a public figure, not only do you have to say something that's wrong and defamatory about them, but you also have to have malicious intent, an intent to defame them. Yeah, I mean, I could say a number of wrong things about you that may hurt your reputation. But if I truly believe that, I can prove I truly believe that, and there was no intent to say this thing maliciously, I can kind of wiggle my way out of that, you know. And so that was the bar number one that Unsworth cleared, that he wasn't a public figure. That made it a little more easier for his case to argue. In terms of the damages, when we get to that, it's really interesting because at the beginning of the case, this wasn't defined. Like these, the kind of fill-in number was like $75,000, which is kind of like a placeholder. Mm-hmm. But and then you get to the closing arguments from Unsworth's side, and they talk about actual damages. They talk about and punitive damages, and there's one more that I'm blanking on the name of. But he has a whiteboard and he draws this thing out. He says, okay, $5 million for actual damages, $35 million for this other type of damages, and I'm trying to think of the name, but and then the last for punitive, which is how do you punish a billionaire from prevent him from saying something like this in the future? What amount is respectable? Could respectably like hurt a billionaire and prevent him from doing this in the future? And he puts $135 million on the board, so a total of $190 million. And everyone in the courtroom is kind of looking around. I mean, because this would have been the largest payout for a defamation case to an individual ever, if the jury decided to kind of award that. And so,
right,
I think people were just kind of amazed by those numbers. I think the average person would agree that is a very large figure. Yeah. And so that's how it kind of proceeded from there.
And, you know, I was reading the reporting you did for BuzzFeed News, and it seems that the way that Elon Musk and his attorneys defended the tweets is they sort of made the claim that, like, if you look at the tweet on its face, that it's not entirely clear who Elon Musk is talking about, and therefore wouldn't meet the bar. Is that correct? Or
yeah, I just remembered. It was assumed damages, by the way, to my last
assume.
Point. actual assumed punitive. But yeah, I mean, so this is actually very interesting because I think in my kind of armchair analysis of the trial, I honestly think Musk's side won on kind of a throwaway point that his defense had like thrown out there, but really wasn't pursuing. And so if you kind of trace their arguments over the 4 days, they were really pushing this idea that pedo guy was an insult. It was not a direct allegation of pedophilia. It was just an insult. It was two men making insults at one another on the playground. Everyone knew that stick it up or whatever Unsworth said. I forgot. Stick it where it hurts was an insult. Mm-hmm. Everyone understood that to be an insult. And everyone understood Musk's pedo guy to be an insult and not an allegation of pedophilia. And that was what the defense was really trying to hammer home there. And what they really went on, because I talked to a juror after the case had concluded, the juror told me that actually there were 5 points that the judge laid out in jury instruction for the jury to kind of establish defamation. Mm-hmm. And that second point, which they all got stuck on, was whether or not a reasonable person could understand that Musk's tweet was about Vernon Unsworth. And if you look at the progression of these four tweets that were being sued over, they actually never mentioned Vernon Unsworth by name. And right. So that was, once they hit that point, they said, well, we can't reasonably, a reasonable person can't determine this, and therefore Musk wins.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously, I'm sure Elon Musk and his team were happy with the results of, you know, how this lawsuit turned out. You know, are there any takeaways that us as normal people can conclude, or, you know, you've had a few days to sort of reflect on this and think about it. Did anything in particular strike you about what you saw in the courtroom and, you know, just sort of how the whole thing played out?
I just am thinking about this whole thing, and I just still can't believe that we spent that much time in court over tweets. And I don't want to belittle Unsworth's case, because I obviously he thought he was harmed and he thought he was hurt. But like, right. it's just absurd. It's kind of just funny to think like that these tweets caused this shitstorm that we then found like became like a year and a half of back and forth, and then we ended up in trial, and then here we are seeing Elon Musk of all people testify over 2 days about the meaning of words and the meaning of insults and the meaning of his tweets. And it felt kind of surreal, you know?
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of when Elon Musk tweeted that when his, you know, when Tesla stock hit 420, that he might take it private, and like
exactly
the SEC freaked out.
I mean, in a similar way that there, I mean, I know you guys talk about figures on the right all the time, and there's no direct comparison to Alex Jones and Elon Musk, but like when people went to go see Alex Jones testify, for example, and mm-hmm. I remember, I wasn't there, but I remember people talking about him. Charlie Wurzel has, my former colleague, has gone to see him testify in court and attend court matters. Like you just kind of lose this veneer of like their public, how you assume them to be when they're public figures. Mm-hmm. And for Alex Jones, of course, it's this crazy persona. For Musk, he was like very reserved, and like I don't know if he's being coached, but like he wasn't this kind of crazy out there, shoot from the hip kind of say anything guy on the stand. And obviously, I guess when you're on the stand, you're probably watching what you say. But it was very different, and I think people were kind of going in there expecting like fireworks or him to kind of put his foot in his mouth. And to his credit, I don't think he ever did. I mean, he cracked a few jokes. And I don't know. The takeaway here is I have a lot of people in my mentions now. It's like slinging the phrase pedo guy around.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen, you know, people just repeatedly tweeting Elon Musk as a pedophile over and over again.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the takeaway.
But. I don't think it's, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's a takeaway for like the last 2 days of like annoying people online. Someone had this, Niraj Agrawal, who's on Twitter a lot, and had this great point that he brought up on Twitter. It was like, it's the subtweet defense. It's like, if I don't mention them in the tweet, I can get away with it. And it's almost like the perfect way of putting it. You know, it's like, and I don't know what implications this will have for defamation law moving forward on the internet, but like, I mean, it's a precedent for sure.
Yeah, yeah, it was a very interesting test of how, you know, cases like this, as our real life and our online lives just continue to blend into this like big gray goop mess where it's all interacting together. You know, these kind of cases, I don't think this is going to be the last kind of Twitter lawsuit that we're going to see come through courts by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah.
So we've been talking with Ryan Mack. He's a senior tech reporter at BuzzFeed News. Ryan, this is Shitpost. So my last question for you, what's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
Oh man. Beyond my replies where people are saying pedophile all the time.
I mean, that's pretty good.
Definitely not that. But I actually wrote about this on BuzzFeed the other day. We have this thing like we highlight our favorite things of the year in tech. And actually, this is kind of a cheat because this is only something that's allowed for BuzzFeed employees. But there's this channel that we have on Slack called Great Tweets. And in Great Tweets, people around the company just put in really good tweets. I mean, they're hilarious. And I spend hours in there on a weekly basis, just like laughing my ass off at things people put in their memes. Sometimes they're just ripped TikTok videos, but it can vary. And I really wish the public could really see into this thing because it's really funny.
Well, you know, if Project Veritas ever needs a BuzzFeed whistleblower, you can just dump the good tweets Slack.
I mean, that would be a scoop for sure, because I feel like that would be a service to the public because it's so funny. But yeah.
All right. Ryan, thanks so much for joining Shitpost. It was a pleasure chatting as always, and I hope you get to decompress and cover something normal for a second. It's just sort of clear your brain out of this stuff for a minute.
At this point, yeah, I'll take anything, but thanks for having me.
The FTC has officially ruled that Cambridge Analytica deceived Facebook users. I think we all knew this, but to get a official ruling from the Federal Trade Commission is something. The scandal first broke 18 months ago. They accused the consulting company Cambridge Analytica, as well as its CEO and app developer, of collecting data on tens of millions of Facebook users through a personality testing app. That data, we would go on to learn, was used to help the Trump campaign win the 2016 election. It was also considered by many a gross violation of privacy rights, and the way that they were collecting the data was a little sketchy, to say the least. The FTC order that came down instructs Cambridge Analytica to delete any data collected on Facebook users and to not make misrepresentations in the future about how it collects data. That doesn't mean much because Cambridge Analytica is completely defunct. It shut down, just very shortly after the scandal was first made public. And, you know, it's just sort of, there's the bigger question about, you know, exactly how powerful Facebook is, should that exist? And at something with that big of a scale, how do you make sure these companies are adequately protecting users' privacy? Bernie Sanders wants us to all be posters. He has a $150 billion Internet for All plan. This might be surprising to people who live on the coast, but more than 31% of Americans still do not have high-speed broadband internet connections. Bernie Sanders hopes to fix that by spending $150 billion that would expand rural access to broadband internet and treat the internet like a public utility. The plan would also break up internet, telecom, and cable giants like Comcast and whatnot. So this is essentially a beefy infrastructure bill. But if Sanders gets the nomination, goes to president, and then also follows through on this kind of promise, what it would do for America, I think, would be transformative. It would bring high-speed internet to people who haven't had it before, potentially. And, you know, with that just means we get more posts. That means we get more posters, more content. And who can be against that? On the last episode of Shitpost, I kind of ranted and raved for a minute about ThinkSpot, which is Jordan Peterson's new Patreon alternative. I was under the impression that he was building this thing with Dave Rubin, but it seems Dave Rubin has his own thing. But that's an aside. Joining Shitpost now, we have the author of the blog, the7thdegree.net. He is an avid ThinkSpot user. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Yeah, so, ThinkSpot is my new favorite social media site. Sort of ended friendship with Twitter and Reddit. ThinkSpot's my new friend.
Yeah, new best friend, baby.
New best friend.
So you actually gave me the invite to ThinkSpot, which thank you, and also go fuck yourself. But hands down, I think maybe one of the worst interfaces I've used. It's confusing. You have to pay to post on it. It's just, it feels so clunky. I mean, what were they thinking?
I have no idea. I mean, they also seem to keep changing it. Like they I went on there over the weekend and it was just absolutely unusable. I couldn't even get to the subscription option, which I would have thought would be their priority over anything else. Like even if the rest of the site goes down, you always want that grift money coming in. But it's I've noted in my sort of Twitter thread on this issue. Like I've spoken to web designers and web security experts, and one of them said it was the worst site he's seen in 10 years of web security. And this is actually a bit of an exclusive. He said he was able to get around all the paywalls,
magnificent.
So I guess they're just succeeding in every possible way.
Yeah, well, you know, now he has to do the thing that they do on like 4chan, where one person gets behind the paywall and then they just make a torrent link. Because I don't want to miss out on my, you know, I don't have $120 a year to spend on Jordan Peterson content, but you know, I might die if I don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, the other most disappointing thing for me is that initially Michaela Peterson, she was also on there. And I was really interested to sort of get all the sort of secrets to her all beef diet. And now she's gone, she's off the site. Whether that's because she couldn't kind of stand the heat, or whether she just didn't have anything much to say, I don't know. But she's removed the option to subscribe to her.
Huh. And then the site also lost the only liberal it had, right? Who was on there?
It
was
David Pakman.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
He said he was going to make a video about it. I haven't seen anything from him, but yeah, I'd be interested to see why he left.
Yeah, I would be interested too, because the big question mark popped up above my head when I saw, you know, they made this big show at the beginning of the year about Dave Rubin, Jordan Peterson joining forces to make a Patreon alternative, because Patreon had the gall to ban somebody for saying the N-word. It split into two things. And just looking at it from the outside, it appears that Dave Rubin has like the more sophisticated thing, and Jordan Peterson has like a first year like web design person trying to build something that is just constantly changing and like not really working like it's supposed to, and with all like just really shoddy security measures. It feels more like the piece I wrote about it, I called it Jordan Peterson's greatest grift to date. And I don't know, man. Who is this for? Who is this website for? Do you know?
No, not really. I mean, it's sort of... I was also under the impression initially that Dave was involved. But yeah, as you said, the thing with Dave, though, he's just reinvented websites, essentially, it seems. I mean, I haven't really been able to figure out how his works, but essentially it just seems like he's just reinvented websites while Peterson's tried to, I don't know, create something completely new, and failed at it. But I guess it's a weird one. Like,
yeah.
Because the thing is, as you said, initially it was because, you know, Sargon got banned from Patreon for saying the N-word on his YouTube channel. But then on ThinkSpot, when I last checked the like terms of service or the guidelines, I've forgotten which one it was, they said that you're not allowed to swear, or you can swear, but they can sort of restrict your, I don't know if it's your content or your if they like take down your post, but they basically said that they don't see profanities as being free speech. So,
right, because if you get this idea, if you don't want to make gab again, like, and you take this to a lawyer, like, every lawyer is going to put in the terms of service, like, no, you have to say that you can edit content on the site, because, like, if someone posts really god-awful shit, like, you have to take it down. It's just the whole vision was just kind of a scam to begin with, but... you know, you wrote this piece on your blog, theseventhdegree.net. It's titled "White Nationalist YouTuber is ThinkSpot's Top User." So, yeah. You know, this question of like, who is this website for? I think, you know, you've found the top four users of the website. And I think maybe that gives us a early window into maybe who, once this site is launched in its full capacity, will actually be using this site and spending, I guess, theoretically, some time on the site.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that's what's going to happen. It's going to be these sort of people who've been kicked off other sites, or I mean, someone like the white nationalist YouTuber I'm referring to is Stefan Molyneux, and he hasn't been banned from Twitter. And I mean, I wouldn't say he doesn't seem to be creating much original content on ThinkSpot, but he is cross-linking all his stuff, and it's sort of now they've even merged the contributor and the sort of user post post into one sort of stream, and they've just split it in half with the contributors, which are, you know, Jordan Peterson's friends and formerly his daughter, and then the user post, which is just everyone else. And I mean, if you scroll down, I mean, you just see his name just popping up over and over again. And I think, at least initially, when the site goes live, I mean, that's what people are going to be subscribing to. Those are the people are going to be attracted, because just the amount of posts that someone like Stefan and people like him are going to have up will sort of draw people towards them, even if they weren't initially even aware of him.
Right, and this is going to be particularly attractive, I think, to Stefan Molyneux's followers, because Stefan's been banned from PayPal. He, you know, has been shut out of these different crowdfunding sites because he makes these inflammatory comments about, you know, white nationalism and immigration, and broadcast them to hundreds of thousands of people. So, you know, how did you calculate, I guess, like, what the biggest users are? Is it just the number of posts that they've made on the site?
Yeah, I mean, okay. I'm not, it's very, very basic. It was literally just going down, and it was very unsophisticated, basically just counting, just adding it up, you know, like each, I sort of went through to look at all the usernames who were posting, and then started counting the ones who were posting the most, and eventually it was, yeah, I narrowed it down to a top three, but the two of the sort of people in third position, there was actually two of them that had an equal number of posts. I don't actually know if that's still the case. I think one of them now might have overtaken the other one, but at the time of writing and publishing, I was looking at the sort of top three, which ended up being four people.
Yeah, you know, even if we can't say, like, for sure, these are the people getting the most financial support on the website or anything, I think the point you made, it was a good one, which is, you know, when this site goes live and people show up and they start looking around, what kind of content are they going to see? And if you have people like Molyneux, and, you know, some of the people we'll touch on here in a second, and that is what's filling the website, it's going to give people a very certain kind of impression about what the website is about. So I guess with that, let's go to number two, Jay DePrisco. Who is this guy?
Jay DePrisco. I believe his full name is John DePrisco. I didn't want to sort of go too much into people's lives if they didn't have a sort of massive public platform. So, but he appears to be a sort of part-time radio host from Florida. He has, on the site, he's written about how he thinks that the QAnon conspiracy movement has a lot of information sure seems legit and inside. I mean, he doesn't seem like a full believer, But I mean, to have someone sort of the second highest posting person on ThinkSpot to be sort of at least a partial QAnon promoter is.
Yeah, you know what this is? This is what people say when they know that they have fans that believe in QAnon, but they don't want to be called a QAnon person, where it's right. Like, I don't know, some of it seems legit, some of it, you know, maybe these people have a point, but it's...
asking questions, you know?
Yeah, I'm just... Why are you so triggered? Did you fact check it? Yeah, why are you so concerned? Like... Okay, so yeah. So we've got, you know, most number of posts on the site. Number one, white nationalist YouTuber. Number two, guy who is at least like seemingly like fine with QAnon at the very least. Mm-hmm.
He's also as I said on his radio show, as I mentioned in the blog, he's had on some local Republican official, and they've talked about some. Well, I don't think it's illegal, but I mean, the guy he was talking to on his show, or the show he was guest hosting, he was saying stuff like, he said, I can take somebody with $2.5 million, put them on Medicaid, and keep the money. And that's what I love about socialist programs. They're written by idiots. It's like, I mean, these aren't like, I don't know, we're not talking about the best sort of people here.
Right.
And sort of talking about the... kind of conspiracies of migrants bringing Ebola into America, and sort of the what they term the downward pressure of migrants on wages. I don't think this guy's like a full on white nationalist or racist like Stefan. I don't think really, from what I've seen, I could say that at all. But
again, unfortunately, that's just sort of like garden variety Republicans right now in America, which I think is. We could talk. Mm. That could be a whole nother discussion about sort of, you know, but let's keep it moving. Joint third place. We've got a tie, or at least a tie from the point that you wrote this blog post.
Yeah.
So we've got, let's see here. We've got GM, I'm not going to try to say it, Goth.
Yeah.
Gothier? Greg Gothier?
I should have looked this up before I came on. I assume that's how it's pronounced. I'll go with that.
You say that he's a software engineer, an amateur philosopher, blogger, and podcaster. Wow, quadruple threat.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, number two is also starting a podcast. It seems that's where it's at right now for ThinkSpot users.
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, this is the 80th episode of this podcast. We were ahead of the curve. if you're going to, you know, align with the left for any reason, I say maybe it's just because we kind of get it a little bit more. But,
yeah.
and then you've got who he's was tied with at the time is someone with the username Lapis. Which I don't know what that. I think there's a restaurant in DC named that, but
I'm sure that's what he's referencing.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. I wasn't able. I mean, I as I said, I didn't spend sort of hours digging into the people, but I couldn't really. I mean, it's also not a very like necessarily. I mean, it is unique in one way, but it's also. I basically couldn't find any other. Accounts of his online, but he's as I said, I mean, he might now be really the third most frequent poster, and the other guy we just mentioned, Greg, he would probably be fourth now. But he's now got the number one trending post on the user feed of ThinkSpot, this is Lapis I'm referring to. My computer's messed up, but it's basically denying flu vaccines.
The flu vaccine is a fraud.
That's the one.
Folks, please get a flu shot. It will save you so much trouble.
It really will.
Let's see, we've got antidepressants will never work to manage mental distress.
Mm-hmm.
Why I support comma, think spot. Oh, man. So, oh, Jesus Christ. Okay. So, anyway, so, you know, these are the top four users on the site at the time that you wrote this. What do you think, you know, your personal takeaway, what does that say about ThinkSpot, maybe where it's at and where it's going?
That's a tough question. I mean, I think it's sort of, it shows that whenever you bill yourself as a platform allowing sort of total free speech and somewhere that you can go if you've been censored elsewhere, you're always going to attract, I don't know how to put it, sort of conspiracists, racists, and sort of other problematic individuals.
Right. There's always the question of, well, why were they banned?
And right.
Usually it's a decently good reason. I mean, these platforms make mistakes sometimes, like the rest of us, but it's... But yeah, I would tend to agree with you there. If you are selling, you know, a key to the Forbidden Kingdom, you shouldn't be surprised when, you know, unsavory folks want to be part of that.
Yeah, it's... I've lost my train of thought.
That's all right. Do you think that this kind of content could potentially hurt Jordan Peterson's reputation at all? I mean, his fans are pretty diehard, but
yeah,
I'm curious if this would be like a stain on his sort of, you know, because he likes to claim all the time, you know, that he's not really supportive of the far right.
No, exactly. I don't know, because I mean, the thing is, I don't think he's been managing his account. I believe he's still in rehab or sort of dealing with personal issues. So he really doesn't seem to have had much sort of direct involvement on the site as of yet. So I think that's going to be very interesting to see what happens when he comes back, and also what the response from sort of his fans and also just the wider public is going to be when the site actually goes live, whenever that's going to be. I mean, at this stage, it's still so unusable. I feel it must be sort of still some time until they're planning on launching it.
Yeah, I can't imagine this thing launches in the next couple of months. There seems to just be a lot of work to do on the site. But, you know, I guess we will be safe from ThinkSpot for at least a couple more months. Well, let's wrap it up here. Mm-hmm. I've been talking with the author of the blog, theseventhdegree.net. Lots of great blogging happening there about these weird figures. I still remember the piece you did about Dylan Wheeler, that like really big QAnon guy. That's a fucking trip, dude.
Yeah, that was a... Yeah, I mean, I because of various work commitments, I haven't been very active on the blog, but that piece is, I mean, the number one sort of traffic drawer to the site, and I think it's just because it's just such a crazy story. And I don't know if you see, I just recently, my most recent post was an update from him, from me, about what he's been up to, blaming accusing Israel for 9/11.
Oh, well,
he's got direct sort of links to Trump Jr. I mean, they follow each other on social media. Trump Jr. shares his stuff on Instagram. They've met at Turning Point USA, and it's just wild how this guy has gone from sort of some absolute random guy to just this, as I said, this high profile QAnon promoter.
I mean, there's got to be a calculation there that like his audience online is worth more than like, I guess his conspiratorial beliefs are damaging. I don't know. again, we could do a whole other episode just about that. this is Shitpost, so what is your favorite thing on the internet right now?
I would have to say it's this Tim Pool take, which he had the other day, which was essentially arguing that, he says the original tweet was the only real means of production is human work ethic. A hardworking person in the woods can produce more than a lazy person in a factory. And he got called out by some people. And someone said, so a hardworking guy with a shovel can outdo a lazy excavator operator using one. And he replied, yes, depending on the laziness. If the dude is sleeping in the excavator, shovel bro gets more done. And then Cody Johnson sort of jumps in saying, a guy in the woods is more productive than a literally unconscious person. Yes. And that obviously, that whole sort of response did not amuse Tim at all.
Yeah, he doesn't have a great sense of humor about himself. I've noticed that.
No, it's a big brain boy. Tim Pool went and sort of just kept doubling down and doubling down and then doubling down again. And I believe in the end he made a YouTube video as well saying, you know, he's not owned and he was actually right. And I mean, he's just beyond parody. It's just so funny.
Oh, okay. I just can't, believe, dude. I had never even thought to consider that like if I go to work I'm like so much more productive than when I'm asleep. It's fucking crazy. All right.
Yeah, that's discourse happening on the right.
Yeah, only the big idea. When we talk about like preserving the marketplace of ideas, these are the ideas that we want to keep saying.
Well, someone actually said they said, I guess even the marketplace of ideas needs a dollar store.
All right. Let's end it there before we say something that's going to get us in trouble. All right. Again, all right, I've been speaking with the author of the 7thDegree.net. Go check out the blog. It's good stuff. And, you know, until next time. Last up, we have a doozy from Jeff Bezos. He said the United States is in, quote, big trouble if big tech rejects military contracts. This comes from John Fingus at Engadget. Amazon, Google, these companies have received criticism, I would say rightly so, for its work and its contracting with the United States military. Jeff Bezos told guests at the Reagan National Defense Forum that the U.S. is in big trouble if these large companies turn their back on the Department of Defense. He argued that the Americans were the good guys and that it was imperative that the U.S. maintain advantages over rivals in areas like spaceflight, where countries like China appear to be catching up with us. So a lot of people have questions about using these massive banks of technology to inform and advance our military, the way we do immigration, that sort of thing. And I think those are valid questions to ask. You know, we trust these companies with a lot of data. And for them to turn it around and give it to law enforcement, police, military contractors, that sort of thing, does feel a little icky. But I think what Jeff Bezos made clear here is that there is no intention to stop doing this. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Shitpost. To get email updates so you make sure you never miss an episode, you can go to our Substack page at shtpost.substack.com. We've got a free newsletter, or you can support the show for $5 a month. And occasionally I like to throw some bonus content behind the paywall to say thank you to the people that help keep this show going. If you want to know more about any of the news stories we discussed on this show or anything we read from on this show, you can go to our show notes at shtpostpodcast.com. I'm your host, Jared Holt, and I'll see you next week.